You're welcome to continue eating, and my understanding is that if I'm not finished by 25 after, you'll just leave on me. Okay. No, I mean, okay, so I'll try to finish by 25 after, rather than okay for you to leave at 25 after. So, as I indicated this morning, and I expect most of you were there, don't know, my overall topic for these three lectures is my attempt to, actually the first time in my life, I suppose, to put together in a sort of synoptic way my own understanding of the relationship amongst faith and philosophy and theology. And I began this morning by arguing that faith does not need from philosophy rational grounding in human nature. I described how in the early Enlightenment and main Enlightenment there arose this enormously influential ideal of rationally grounding in our human nature, our religious beliefs, indicated a little bit about the power of that ideal, and showed why I think we ought not to accept it. That doesn't mean that anything goes in religious belief, but it does mean that it's not the case that it has to be rationally grounded in human nature. Now this afternoon, in these few minutes, I want to turn my attention in pretty much the opposite direction, I suppose, and talk about the role of faith in philosophy as I see it, the role of faith in philosophy. And I think it's once again important for you and me not just to think about these things in total ahistorical abstraction, but to be somewhat aware of the historical situation in which we talk about these matters. So here goes. It's my impression that until about 25 years ago, 30, 25 years ago, whatever, it was still possible to speak of a dominant self-understanding of the Western Academy. And when I put it like that, I think that this dominant self-understanding has been collapsing and becoming more fragmented and so forth. But until 25 years ago when I entered as a teacher, it was possible to speak of it. That dominant self-understanding had a number of components, which I could talk about, but I want this afternoon to single out only one, the one that's directly relevant to my purposes. I think what can be said is this. Until 25, 30 years ago, the work of the Academy was understood as a generically human enterprise, something we engage in simply as human beings. Let me put the point metaphorically. The idea was that when you enter the university, the college, academia, that when you enter, before entering the academy proper in the narthex, you strip yourself of all your particularities. You strip yourself of your religion, your ethnicity, your gender, your social class, your nationality. And only when you've rendered non-functional all your particularities are you ready truly to engage properly in the work of the academy. When I was a graduate student at Harvard some 40 years ago, there was no such thing, nor any such talk as feminist studies, as Afro-American studies, and you name it. And when I reflect back on that, if anybody had ever come up and said, you know, I think we ought to have feminist studies, everybody, if not completely baffled by what was being said, would have dismissed it out of hand as obviously inappropriate to the academy. So you people live in a way in which I can describe for you, but it's very difficult for you to feel. You live in a profoundly different era. Now, the changes in these 40 years have been absolutely staggeringly enormous. I think nothing of the sort has happened in the Western Academy for 400 years of its existence. And I think, as this morning, I think once again that we can use John Locke to advance our understanding of how that was all thought of. And my part of my reason for using John Locke is that I do think he's a terrifically formative figure, but also I've studied him and written a book on him and so forth, so I know about him. You remember this morning I said that Locke insisted that when it comes to matters of what he sort of charmingly called maximal concernment, things that concern you more than anything else, when it comes to such matters, and religion, he thought, was for everybody one of those. When it comes to matters of maximal concernment, we ought not to appeal to our traditions but we ought instead simply to follow this method, and he saw this method as a sort of generically human method. Now, in making his proposal that we apply that method, Locke was, he's sometimes described this way, but I'm persuaded, Locke was not so naive as to think that when you function as a philosopher, a chemist, a psychologist, and so forth, Locke was not, or when you applied his method, he was not so naive as to think that you could empty your head of all that you believed. Locke simply did not think that. In fact, he argues against it. And then with empty head, start employing his method. That's not what Locke believed, but here's what he did believe. Locke assumed that it's possible, to speak metaphorically, to put your beliefs in cold storage, the beliefs that you've acquired from tradition and wherever, your religious beliefs, your other ones, that it is possible, as it were, to put your beliefs in cold storage, not to appeal to them, and you still believe these things, but you're just not going to make use of them in the academy. In the academy, you simply use your eyes and your rational capacities for reflection and so forth. That was Locke's picture. And that, it seems to me, has been, as I see it, the reigning self-understanding of the Western Academy ever since, that it's possible to render our particularities non-functional, not to get rid of them, nobody supposed that, but to render them, for the time that you're functioning as chemist, as philosopher, even as theologian, to render them non-functional, not to appeal to them, and just to follow, just to make use of your indigenous human capacities. Now, here's the next step. I think that that vision, and I've had to speak about it too briefly, I suppose, to fully communicate its visionary quality, but it was visionary. In the middle of all our disagreements, it's possible to construct, to engage in the life of the academy simply as human beings. That's the vision. That doesn't mean that you have shucked off all your particularities. You still go to church, you still have your family and so forth, but when it comes to the life of the academy, that makes no difference. That's the vision. And it's visionary. Now, I think, here's the next point, that vision lies on a mistaken assumption. And I never cease to be interested by the fact that Locke himself, in the next to last chapter of his great essay, shows why it's mistaken, though without ever realizing that that's what he's done. So let me start off with Locke's example, showing why, here's the idea, you can just render what you already believe non-functional and just operate as a generic human being in the academy. In that next to last chapter, Locke asks this question: why do people make mistakes in the use of his method? Now, that's a really interesting question. Why do people, you know, I sketched his method this morning, it was practice. Why do people make mistakes in that method? And especially in the course of that, he asks this question: why do people make mistakes in estimating the probabilities? Remember how probabilities came on? You're supposed to collect this evidence, and then you calculate the probability of the issue that you're concerned with on that set of evidence. So Locke asks this question. He says, people sometimes make mistakes in estimating probability, when they ought to be functioning just as really good human beings. Now why, why would they make mistakes? Here's what he says. It's got a sort of anti-Catholic structure to its example, but here's what Locke says. He gives an example. For example, he says, a child, a person reared from childhood on in Catholicism, will believe with great firmness the doctrine of transubstantiation, will take it as an obvious and fundamental truth. In fact, parenthesis, in fact, says Locke, it's patently false. But this person reared in Catholicism will take it to be an obvious truth, so much so that anything else that contradicts this doctrine of transubstantiation, even self-evident things which contradict the doctrine of transubstantiation, will, instead of being used to refute the doctrine of transubstantiation, it'll flip the other way around, and they'll deny those things so as to hold on to the doctrine of transubstantiation. Upside down, you see? What is really self-evident, they'll deny on the doctrine that it conflicts with transubstantiation, when what they ought to do is flip it in the other direction. Since these things are self-evident, they ought to deny the doctrine of transubstantiation. Let me give some more relevant examples of the same type. I don't know very much about mathematics. It was never a favorite subject of mine. So I'm intimidated by mathematicians. So if a mathematician friend of mine would call me someday and take some theorem of mathematics that I'd always taken to be true and say, you know, Nick, we here in the Princeton math department have just made the most astonishing discovery. We've discovered that that's false. I'm pretty sure that I know what my response would be. My response would be, still seems true to me, but I guess it's not. Would be my response. Or let's take an example from the field of perception. You see this of the same type as the Locke example? These self-evident truths seem false, as the Catholic, but seem true indeed, these self-evident truths that conflict with the doctrine of transubstantiation. They seem true, but they can't be true because they conflict with the doctrine of transubstantiation. Transubstantiation is true. Or a perceptual example. I see a chair off in the distance, but I've been led to think that what I'm seeing is a very skillfully painted backdrop for a play that's to be performed. That is just painting on the wall, fool the eye painting. So I know what would happen in my case. I'd see a chair, and in the normal run of events, I'd believe that there was a chair there. But in this case, I say, well, it sure looks like a chair, but it must not be. It must be a really, really, really good two-dimensional representation of a chair. You begin to see my point, and Locke's point, though Locke doesn't fully elaborate it. Here's the point. The beliefs we already have play a role in what beliefs and non-beliefs will come to have in the future. Locke's official picture was, you set your beliefs that you already have in cold storage, and now you just use your capacities of perception and reflection and so forth. Here's the alternative picture emerging. That's not how it goes. Beliefs don't just sit in a sort of cold storage. Here's what happens. The beliefs you already have become part of your belief-forming self. Maybe computer imagery helps. The tempting thought and Locke's thought was it's just our hardwiring that functions to form our beliefs. But his example and the examples I've given shows you that the operating system, or actually probably the software that you've acquired, becomes part of the system that forms future beliefs. Our belief-forming selves are artifacts of our experience and not just of our generic nature. I hope that's clear enough. Now suppose we let that truth sink in, that the beliefs we already have don't just occupy a sort of cold storage system in the self, but become part of the software that determines what new beliefs you're going to have. So whether or not this perception of a chair forms the belief that there's a chair depends on what beliefs you have. If you believe that it's a skillfully painted stage set, you won't have the belief. Let's let that sink in. Then we have to adopt a very different picture of the academy. The old picture was that in the narthex, you see to it that you put all your particularities, including the beliefs you've already got in cold storage, and you enter just qua human being. In that way, we all begin from exactly the same place. But on this alternative picture, which seems to me utterly compelling, the beliefs we already have and the attitudes we have, I haven't talked about the attitudes, are part and parcel of that self which enters the academy, part of our operating system or software. So here's the consequence. I think we have no alternative but to understand ourselves as entering the academy as who we are and with what we are, rather than that old stripping off picture, stripping off the particularities, for the simple reason that, to say it one more time, the beliefs you already have become part of your belief-forming self. Now, I've just given you a theoretical argument for the conclusion that the beliefs and attitudes we already have are part and parcel of the self which functions in the academy, and that there's no hope of altering that fact. You cannot just strip them off or put them in cold storage. Now let me make quickly this point. As you all know, what I've argued for on this theoretical basis by talking about what is the belief-forming self has also been happening historically in the academy in the last 25 years. So let me say just a word about that. Once again, the old understanding was in the academy we function as generic human beings. Political changes took place. Oh, and one more thing, in the academy 40 years ago, I remember it, was inhabited mainly by, it's true, white males. Political changes took place in American society and Western society generally, so that women and Afro-Americans and other minority groups began being represented in the academy in ways in which they simply were not when I was a young grad student. And that eventually had this effect. Women and others began saying, look, you guys, what you represent as generically human looks pretty masculine to us. It doesn't look all that generic. And blacks began saying, what you represent as generic doesn't feel very generic to us. It feels, in some respects, white. Now, you could respond to that charge in various ways. One of the first examples of that charge was Carol Gilligan talking about Kohlberg's study of moral formation, in which Kohlberg talks about these stages in moral formation until we reason in purely general terms of justice and so forth. And Gilligan said, that feels very masculine to me. And then it turned out that Kohlberg's examples had in fact all been young males, and he hadn't studied any women and so forth. But he represented it as the human stages in human ethical formation. Now, it would have been possible to respond in various ways. It would have been possible for the inhabitants of the old inhabitants of the academy to say, yeah, you're right. So I guess what we better do is try to be more generic. That's in a way been the response of most people in the hard sciences. Another response would have been possible like this. Yeah, I guess you're right. It has been sort of male scholarship that we've been engaged in, but by gum, that's a good thing, and we're going to see what we can do to preserve it. The main response outside of the hard sciences has been, yeah, that's true. And maybe we ought to start rethinking the possibility of this old image of purely generic human learning. And that's produced a very different academy that you people enter from the one that I entered. And that's legitimated feminist learning and you name it. So, this next point. So where does this leave the Christian scholar? Well, I think pretty obviously it leaves the Christian scholar in the same position as every other scholar. Namely, one enters the academy as who one is, and then starts engaging in the work of the academy. Of course, coming back to my point this morning, it may be that some of the beliefs you enter with, you're not entitled to. You've been sloppy and so forth. You should correct that. But otherwise, the Christian enters the academy as who he or she is, a believer, and proceeds to do the work of the academy. One more point here, really important one. The examples I've given, three examples, one from Locke and the example of my mathematical friend and the example of perception, those were all examples of glitches in our programming, false beliefs which then enter into our belief-forming selves and function obstructively. If things were going well, I'd believe that there's a chair up there, but there's this false belief which says it's a really skillfully painted backdrop, and so I don't believe it. Glitches. Now this next enormously important point. We ought also to allow for the opposite possibility that some at least of the beliefs we already have and have entered into our belief-forming selves enable rather than obstruct our access to reality. Okay? The picture that you'd come away with my examples is that this self is always an obstructive, is prejudice and blindness and so forth. But we ought to consider the opposite possibility, that sometimes you have to be formed in a certain way as a belief-forming self before certain aspects of reality are available to you. That, I take it, is really what the feminists are saying. Typically, not invariably, being a woman enables you to have access to certain understandings of reality. And that's what the Christian scholar will think, that his or her Christian belief isn't a blinder, but it's an enabler. And I could give you lots of other examples of that. Some of you have studied David Hume. Hume's analysis of our beliefs about the future says that until you've been formed in certain ways by certain experience, you can't have beliefs, inductive beliefs about the future. So, bringing it to a conclusion, what does this all mean for our understanding of the Christian philosopher and more generally the Christian academic? I think pretty clearly it means this, that we are back after an interlude to the Augustinian picture of faith seeking understanding. Not of faith wanting understanding to gird it up and so forth, but of faith seeking understanding. Rather than philosophy in the hands of the Christian being an enterprise in which one tries to provide rational grounding for the faith, philosophy is an enterprise of looking at the world through the eyes of faith. Only, my scholarly scruples require me to say this, only we've got to understand it somewhat differently from how Augustine and Anselm understood it. When they used the formula faith seeking understanding, they meant that we should try to understand those very things that already we believe. So it was the project for a theology, moving beyond mere belief to theology. I think it's this. What I mean by the motto is, one allows one's Christian self to shape one's practice of the philosophical enterprise, just as naturalist selves shape their practice of the academic enterprise and humanist selves shape their practice of the enterprise. And one more time, and the Christian does not regard this as due to the fact that Christianity is an inescapable set of blinders for them, but Christianity is, okay, yields privileged cognitive access. A motto which has gained a lot of currency in the Christian college movement in the last 30 years is integration of faith and learning. And in some ways that's had a healthy result, but that's not the picture I've got in mind. That's the picture of two things, faith and learning, and then you try to tie them together in summer seminars and 6-week seminars and so forth. My experience as a Christian scholar is not that there are these two things, faith and learning, and then I got to figure out how to tie them together, but it's philosophy informed by faith. It's Christian philosophy through and through. There's no two-ness to it. I don't know how else to describe it. Let me close then with two caveats. One is this. I find that when I and others speak of the project then of, in these terms, Christian philosophy, the objection will often be raised, but look, Walterstorff, when you and your colleagues do it, it turns out to be on so many points similar to what other people do. So what do you mean the project of Christian philosophy? Okay. The point and test of Christian philosophy, faith-seeking understanding, is not that it's different at every point. The test is not difference, but fidelity. And on reflection, why would you expect what the Christian does to be different at every point from what everybody else does? That strikes me as presupposing a heretical view of creation. We're fallen, yes indeed, but we're not totally blind to reality. So my feeling is the opposite. If I have done my best to allow my faith to inform my philosophy, and there are people who are not Christians who say, yeah, I pretty much agree with that, I think I should rejoice in that, not say, shucks, I got to do it differently. I guess I didn't bring it off this time. So difference and not fidelity is the test. And secondly, the best way I can put this second caveat is this. The Christian philosopher and the other Christian academics have to learn to be bilingual. One speaks at length and in detail to one's own Christian colleagues, but one also speaks, and you have to use a somewhat different language, to your non-Christian colleagues. And I seek, when I write philosophy, well, I write both kinds of things. Sometimes I write for the Christian community, and sometimes for philosophers in general. And when I do the latter, I try to find arguments for my position, which I think they will find cogent. Maybe sometimes different arguments for different people, but which they will find cogent. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But one does one's best to speak in two tongues. That, as I see it, as briefly as I can put it, is the role of faith in philosophy. It shapes one's philosophy.